Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagram Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is John Bailuni, the Chief Operating Officer of Leonardo DRS. Leonardo is one of the co-sponsors of our coverage of the Virtual Association of the United States Army's annual meeting, this year dubbed AUSA Now. John, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vagyo. Appreciate the opportunity.
It's great having you on. Unfortunately, this is a virtual time, so we're not having an opportunity to talk in person, either before, at, or after AUSA, as the case is, unfortunately, because of the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. As you know, we had a terrific conversation with your CEO, Bill Lynn, former Deputy Defense Secretary. And, you know, I asked him about how the company itself has adapted to COVID. What I'd like to ask you is, every single one of the military services, including OSD, has changed how they're doing business and how they're interacting with the industrial base. And I wanted to get your sense on how the changes at the government level have driven, in turn, changes in how you guys are interfacing, whether it's more remote meetings, we're finding certifications are being done instead of teams of 12 or a handful by individual people. The Navy, did a ship commissioning with a submarine that was actually underway and underwater. How are these changes changing in turn how you're doing the actual mechanics and day-to-day operating and interfacing with the customer?
Vago, that's an outstanding question. I think I would summarize first and say that it's evolving. When we started and the pandemic became prevalent, we saw a lot of customers going home. We saw tests delayed. Then we started seeing some innovations. And some of the innovations that we saw were acceptance of product with video. We saw a lot of those kinds of ideas coming forward to interact with our workforce that are actually in our plants. Our interactions with our customers have become more prevalent since then. And we're doing a lot of virtual meetings, a lot of video meetings, and you certainly lose something in that process, but you're not losing a lot anymore. I think when we first started, it was difficult. No one had the right tools. We were doing phone calls. You couldn't see people's faces. Now with the video, it's a lot nicer, and we're able to have full spectrum discussions. It still requires us to be present, whether we're at our facilities. About 60% of our employees are working in our facilities. We've done a good job of isolating them so that they're in teams, small teams, and our customer still needs to be present there in some cases. We're also sending people to support our equipment overseas in some cases and they have to follow the appropriate quarantine mm-hmm. procedures in the countries that they're going. But it is evolving over time, and it seems to be getting to a stabilized place where we have regular communications with our customers. We have some innovations taking place. The testing of our products is taking place almost regularly now. So I think that we've all kind of adapted. I don't want to say this is the new normal because I think we're going to get back someday to where we were, at least close to where we were. But it has been working.
And in terms of the impact on the workforce, I mean, have you guys been having many cases, and how are you dealing with it, right? I mean, 210,000 plus Americans have unfortunately, at least that many have been claimed by coronavirus. Infection rates are still a challenge and going up in many parts of the country, unfortunately, and including the world where folks thought, you know, we had been through the worst of this and it's coming back. What's the impact been on the workforce so far, right? You guys are taking precautions, which is terrific. But at the end of the day, you know, even if people try not to get it, unfortunately, they may end up getting it. What is the kind of impact that's been that you guys have experienced so far?
It's a good question. Certainly, from the very beginning, we put the safety of our employees and their families on the top of the list. So the approaches that we've been taking in terms of separating our folks into small teams when they're in the facility, and then actually paying those teams to stay home when one person feels sick, have had a very positive impact on the infection rate. We have had a number of infections, but a very small percentage of them are happening inside our facility. I would say less than 1% are happening within our facilities. But they are getting, people are still getting infected from their families and friends and doing life outside of the business. But we've been able to contain that. Certainly when someone gets sick, we take care of their families. We've been sending food to their families and things like that, just to make sure that their families stay safe. We've been helping them to stay safe when they're at home. The effect on the business is only slight. We've only had about an average of about 1% of our employees out on quarantine at any one point in time. That's an acceptable level for us. But again, keeping our families, our employees and families safe is our number one priority. I think we've been doing a good job there. But as you said, infection rates are rising. We have had a number of employees test positive. We're doing what we can to ensure that it doesn't pass on inside our facilities.
One of the questions, and then I do want to get to AUSA and technology. Everybody has also seen, you know, on the one hand, companies are saving money in terms of travel and not traveling as much as they need to. Obviously, major trade shows and things have been interrupted like this one, which would be a major investment for any company, even if the company is based in the Washington, D.C. area. At the same time, you have added costs in terms of training, and added costs in terms of cleaning and, you know, how to readjust production lines and what have you. Have you guys quantified what the cost impact is? And I know that there's some debate going on up on the Hill on whether or not these costs should be reimbursed and how. I think everybody agrees that this is sort of act of God stuff and that industry should be reimbursed for what are justified increases in cost. Any sense on what that cost impact is and how important it would be for the department to try to work with contractors to try to alleviate that burden, especially if, God forbid, this tends to last longer than anybody had initially anticipated?
Yeah, I won't weigh in on the debate, but I will say that we certainly have costs. The cost of quarantining people has not been insignificant. It has been partially offset by the savings of travel and the costs that you've talked about. But we still have a net positive cost. We would like to see that reimbursed if possible. It certainly has affected our suppliers as well. We've done surveys of our suppliers, asked for their responses. We've helped 100 of them respond appropriately. We've given our procedures to them and helped them tremendously get through this. And that's lowered our risk as well. But there are impacts down there, and we'd like to see those impacts get reimbursed if possible. But I won't weigh in on the overall debate. I know that it's an area that's that will go back and forth between the Hill and the department.
Let me take you to AUSA. As I mentioned, we would be have been having this conversation in person had it not been unfortunately for the virus. Talk to us a little bit about what you're highlighting at this AUSA now this year, right? I mean, obviously the show is a great opportunity to put the company's foot forward. You guys have a very sophisticated digital approach that you're taking to both communicate to the public and to reporters, but as well as to your customers. What are the capabilities, technologies, and products, John, you guys are highlighting this year?
Well, you know, Avago, we're a very diverse business, and we have technologies, products, and solutions that meet many of our customers' needs. And we focus on this show on a couple of areas. One is network communications. We're the largest supplier of rugged computing platforms to the Army. We're the largest supplier of commercial bandwidth to the Department of Defense. So we're highlighting that as part of our as part of this show. Force protection is a big part of our business today. The proliferation of state-of-the-art technology and advancements in GPC states. Our platforms and bases are now more vulnerable than they have been. And so we've done a lot of work in infrared countermeasures. We've done a lot of work in short-range air defense and counter UAS. And we've done work in active protection and hard kill. And those are areas that we're featuring here at the show, the force protection element of our business. Social lethality is another area we're focusing on. We have the future weapon sight business at both individual and crew serve for the soldier. And they interface with the IVAT, new IVAT system and the EMVGB. Lastly, we're focusing on electronic warfare. Not lastly, but we are focusing on electronic warfare. We're able to show really world-class EW SIGINT cyber capability for dismounted soldiers as well as mounted systems. And they're playing these. We've been able to play a key part of the Army's new EW programs. We also see the department needing more power. And power is an area where, as we increase sensing, we increase EW and cyber capabilities, directed energy and so forth, as well as computing at the platform level, the department needs more power. And so we're highlighting our capability to develop power inside the platforms themselves. All of these areas that we're demonstrating demonstrate our ability to be innovative and provide state-of-the-art capabilities for our customers and the ones that they're demanding today.
Let's talk a little bit about long-term investments, right? I mean, you talked about the capability you're bringing across the portfolio. So this is kind of a two-part question. Part one of the question is, what are the areas where you're putting some of that investment? You know, we talked to Bill about that a little bit, but want to get a little bit more granular with you, right? I mean, everybody is talking about artificial intelligence. Everybody is talking about quantum, so much so that in some cases, for some, it's becoming, hey, do you want some AI with that and some quantum with that, right? I mean, it's becoming buzzwordy, even if there are folks who are actually making genuine investment in that capability. Talk to us about how you guys are investing and sure. How that investment strategy is shaped not only at developing better capability, but better connecting the portfolio of capabilities you have as well. Because one of the things you guys are doing are bringing, for example, some naval power technology over to the Army, right? So talk to us about how that individual investment is working and how that individual investment in these discrete capabilities actually allow you to better connect your kind of wide existing portfolio for new applications.
Sure. So just in general, we focus our investments in the area of the market that are growing the fastest. Okay, so we'll take about 80 to 85% of our investment budget, discretionary budget, and focus that amount of money in the key markets that are growing. We spoke about some of the areas that we're showing at the show: network computing, force protection, long-range sensors, electronic warfare, and power. Those are the areas that we focus our investments on. Okay, these are so not just the network computing element of computing platforms, but also the connectivity of sensors and the processing of those sensors to do sensor fusion. Force protection is an area where we're focusing a lot of attention, not just missile defense or missile warning, but also infrared countermeasures, counter UAS, not just kinetic, but also electronic warfare, and then the future directed energy. Electronic warfare, not just SIGINT, also EA, electronic attack, as well as cyber. And these broad categories of investment pools, and you spoke about power as well, bringing power generation and conversion from one platform to another. Each of these areas are diverse in that they touch upon several of our businesses and several of our key technology areas and capabilities. And so what we're trying to do is not just invest in products themselves, but capabilities in market areas that are growing. We've also invested, and we invest in the same kind of things that you're talking about, in disruptive technologies. We do put some money in areas that will be groundbreaking. We do some quantum sensing and AI. And in the quantum world, I'll give it a little more granularity here. We've found that we have techniques that will provide increased signal-to-noise ratio in some applications. And I won't get into the applications, but I will say that this is a combination of bringing the noise down and bringing the signal up using quantum techniques. And so this is an area that I think is of interest to a lot of our customers, although this is a very new science, and it's more in 6.1 than it is in 6.2 today. In the area of AI, you know, as you mentioned, you know, give me a little AI with that, and you know, I'll open the can and sprinkle some AI on our product. AI it means a lot of things to a lot of different people, but the idea of bringing a lot of data into a computing infrastructure and processing that data to provide information is cumbersome. It requires, in most cases, it requires a lot of tagging. And tagging of AI data is cumbersome and it's error prone. And so we've developed a way to do recognition without tagging. And so we think this is a breakthrough in areas that we would like to pursue. But again, I would say this is more 6.2 than 6.3 and more 6.2 than 6.1. But these are areas that we put a little bit of money in to see where the market's going and see if we can disrupt the market.
Let me ask you about sort of where we are and where we're going. One of the most intriguing elements of that September 3 air defense test was the series of technologies that were used by the Army Air Force team to employ howitzers, cannon artillery, to shoot down incoming cruise missiles. And that's there were a whole bunch of sophisticated algorithms, warning, right? You had to do detection, very, very complex ballistics associated with it. Dr. Roper, who's the Air Force acquisition executive, was talking about this kind of capability when he was the head of the DoD Strategic Capabilities Office 7 years ago. You know, we talked about that this was a vision and you're now accomplishing it. Obviously, everybody recognizing the challenges posed, for example, by Chinese area denial capabilities. How much of the future, John, is going to be knitting and actually bridging existing systems, right? I mean, how much of this is going to be, for lack of a better word, using quantum, sort of a quantum game for actually what might be a modest, how much of your effort is going to the development of sort of, everybody has a tendency of thinking about, oh my God, this will be a leap ahead, highly classified system, as opposed to actually having a whole bunch of stuff that we've already developed, just using that developed capability, maybe either more closely linked or differently linked or different things being used in different ways, right? I mean, how do we need to think about the future we're going into, especially at a time when people want faster and faster and faster cycles?
Well, I think it's an outstanding question because I think if you look at what's happening in the U.S., versus what's happening in other countries, some of our near peers. In the US, we tend to develop systems on their own. We tend not to connect them or think about how to connect them. And if you look at what's happening in our near peers, what you see is a system of systems. And they're always thinking about connecting them from the very beginning. So having a new capability in the U.S. Could be as simple as connectivity, JADC2, or some any sensor, any shooter approach connectivity. This drives communication bandwidth. It drives computing at the edge. It drives AI. And so these are all areas that we work in that we'd like to see. Or proliferate. Obviously, we talked a little bit about our capability in communications, but the department needs more bandwidth, they need lower latency, and they need more reliability and more assurance. And we can provide that. In order to connect any sensor to any shooter, you're going to need that. In order to determine and target with a howitzer, as you in that example, you're going to need to do some computing at the edge. And so you're going to need some rugged computing. You're going to need some AI. So you're going to need more computing at the edge. That computing at the edge and the sensors are going to need more power. And so each of these areas are areas that we're investing in and the department's investing in as well. And so I think we're in sync. But I do think your overall point is a good one. Connecting together existing programs and existing capability is going to be the next capability.
Let's talk as much as we've been talking about future capabilities, let's talk about some of the partnerships that you may need to be getting there. How are you, at this point, whenever anybody talks about artificial intelligence, John, right, there's this sense that a lot of highly innovative companies are working on it across a very, very broad base. But now you've also got sort of the Googles and the Amazons of the world, which are putting billions of dollars a year in annual investment, right? Some titanic numbers because of the commercial gain that's seen in it. And we've seen that in other market segments as well, where it's not defense contractors and the Pentagon that's actually in the vanguard. It's on a commercial industry. How are you working with commercial companies, sort of commercial pure play commercial companies, but as well as academia to build those kind of partnerships at a time when, despite the advanced nature of your capabilities, there's some stuff that's actually going on in the commercial world that with the right kind of adaptation gets more, so how are you working those angles of balancing your own internal investment and what you're getting out of partnership and working with leading academic institutions?
Well, let me say, Vago, that this has always been a strength of DRS. Our ability to find a technology that's either commercially available or available overseas in some cases that's needed by the department and bringing it to market has been a key strength of our business for a long time. Many times we find that there'll be a small commercial company that just doesn't know how to do business with the Department of Defense. They don't understand the FAR, the DFAR. It can be a very daunting and complex process to get a contract and pass the muster from DCMA and DCAA. And so we very, very often, we start with the SBIR program and we look at the winners, the small business winners of those programs. And we say, let's help them. Sometimes we invest in the company. Sometimes we put matching funds in on a phase two SBIR, and to try to help that company along and help to kind of front them into the DoD space. But sometimes we find technology exists already, whether it's overseas that we can bring to an urgent need in the U.S. And we've done I thought we did a good job with the trophy system, bringing APS to the U.S. Army in an urgent need way. We partnered with Rafael and brought that technology over and satisfied that need pretty quickly. Those are the kinds of things we do. We also do some work with academia. We put some money in academia to fund research. So that has some advantages and disadvantages to it. But there's some good research happening there. And so we want to take advantage of that, but we want to make sure that it doesn't leak out of the United States if we're doing something that's more critical for the US. So we do that very selectively, and we have a number of relationships with universities across the US.
And let me ask you one last question, which is about delivering. You guys have had a spate of major contracts that you guys have won, including some, SHORAD, which is now going into production. Winning is half the battle, as the saying goes. The other half is delivering on time and budget. Talk to us a little bit about the investment and the focus you guys are making in, efficient production at scale and speed.
Yeah, so we know that winning is only part of the battle, and we know that we can't let our customers down. We have a program that we started last year that's focused on operational excellence. And this program is about making sure that we satisfy our customers better and better every day. This program is about unifying our procedures across the company, unifying our tools, unifying our metrics, so we can measure the things that will make a difference and drive our procedures to be better and better. We always have to make sure that we're doing the right things for our customers and satisfying our customers. So we have to be more demanding than our customer is on ourselves. This is the hallmark of this program. It's excellence in everything we do. And we focus, we're focusing a lot of attention on this now, especially in light of the award that you just talked about with SHORAD. We know that the Army is placing a lot of emphasis and trusting us to deliver, and we will deliver on time for this, as we did with the prototypes. This is a great program for the Army. It's a great program for us. We look forward to doing this on other things as well.
John, thanks so very, very much. Really appreciate it. Best of luck. And look forward to having you on again to give us a follow-up on this. A lot of fascinating points and a lot of great fodder for future conversation. Thanks very much again, sir.
Thanks, Vago. Appreciate the time and the opportunity.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.